Doug Traversa is our speaker today. He is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Tullahoma. He completed his seminary studies at Meadville Lombard Theological School in Chicago. Doug is a retired Air Force officer, and he and his wife, Jancy, live in Tullahoma. Their three children are all adults and out on their own. Today, Doug will speak on the topic, Listening for the Gadfly. Let's welcome our speaker, Doug Traversa.
Well, this one should be a little bit interesting because as I worked on it, I started with the concept of let's take a look at some writings and some words of someone who is a Unitarian Universalist, or at least in that world, and has some critiques of Unitarian Universalism. And by the end of this sermon, I had found, and I say this in absolute seriousness, one of the most profound theological or philosophical statements I've encountered in all my years of studying and preparing sermons and everything else. And it comes from none other than Terry Pratchett, the writer of the Discworld books. And if you're familiar with that, mostly they're funny. But today I'm going to end with a challenge from his pen. And I do truly think it's profound and meaningful. So we're going to cover quite a lot of ground today. First of all, the word gadfly, it's actually listening to the gadfly. I don't know if I wrote it wrong when I sent it in or if it got lost in translation. But if you don't know what a gadfly is, I'm going to give you the dictionary definition. A gadfly is an annoying person, especially one who provokes others into action by criticism. Now, it may not be fair to call the people that I'm going to be quoting annoying, but they certainly do criticize or offer critique, and they seek to provoke into action. So that's where the title comes from. When I'm finished, you can decide if anyone, including me, actually meets the criteria of being annoying. Throughout this year, those of you who've heard me speak a few times know I've been going through the history of Unitarian Universalism, occasionally talking about where we can be in the future. Today, as part of that overall theme for 2016, what are some of the things that we might do better taking those critiques from people who are within our world? Not from people from the outside looking at us, but people who've actually lived the life and say, here's something I think is wrong, something we can do better. Now, most of us, if we're really honest, aren't big fans of criticism of ourselves. Even if it's done in the best of spirits, if it's constructive criticism and it's done in love, most of us, at least to some degree, most of us don't really like to be told, you could do something better. Most of us like to live under the illusion that, as Mary Poppins used to say, I'm practically perfect in every way. We know it's not true, but we love that illusion anyhow. Or, conversely, we know what our shortcomings are, and we really don't need you telling us because we already know, and it's sort of like piling on in football, unnecessary roughness, throw the flag 15 yards, because I'm well aware of all the stuff I screw up on a day-to-day basis, and you know, you don't really need to tell me. I've already got that under control, at least the understanding of it, if not the living out of overcoming it. Now, this may be true also as we consider our congregation. Hopefully, you have a certain amount of love and appreciation for this congregation, for Unitarian Universalism, for the freedom it allows, for the encouragement it gives you as you seek truth and meaning, a way to live better. And so, when you hear someone critique it, that might make you get a little bit defensive. And that's a good thing in one sense, because if it's something you love, you don't want people picking at it. On the other hand, no one's perfect, no thing is perfect, and we could possibly improve. Whether the critiques you hear today you think are valid or not is up to you. And I don't necessarily agree with all of them, but I think they're very good things to think about. And we're going to start our first critique from that fount of wisdom, that source of all things true and good, The Simpsons. The Simpson family is attending a church ice cream social, and Lisa's looking at all the choices. Wow, look at these flavors. Blessed Virgin Berry Commandment and Bible Gum. And the Reverend Lovejoy says, or if you prefer, we have Unitarian ice cream. And he hands Lisa an empty bowl. There's nothing here, says Lisa. Exactly, says Lovejoy. So I guess you've hit the big leagues if the Simpsons are critiquing you. But our main gadfly today is Davidson Lair. He's a former musician, a combat photographer, and press officer in Vietnam. He has a PhD in methods of studying religion, theology, and the philosophy of religion, and the philosophy of science, with an additional focus on language philosophy from the University of Chicago. From 1986 to 2009, he served as a Unitarian Universalist minister. And he's also been a fellow in the Jesus Seminar since 1992, which is the group of people who try to figure out what stuff in the Bible Jesus really said and the stuff that was added later. He was a minister at two Unitarian Universalist churches during his career, but he did not refer to himself as a Unitarian Universalist, but rather as a religious liberal. He challenges us in many ways, and whether or not you agree with him is entirely up to you. And please don't assume I do just because I'm quoting his writings. But if your values and beliefs are to be worthwhile, they must withstand scrutiny, and you should be willing to hold them up to the light of scrutiny and critique. So let's see what he has to say. In an article in the Journal of Liberal Religion, with the very, very catchy and uplifting title of Why Unitarian Universalism is Dying, he confronts what he considers our empty center. It's not a coincidence in the late 1970s, Unitarians were heard to complain that our kids don't know what to tell their classmates what we believe. Looking back, this was a disingenuous statement. The problem was not that kids didn't know what they believed. The problem was that Unitarian ministers and adults didn't know what they believed. And you have to extend this. They didn't know what they believed that mattered at all in the larger scheme of things because their beliefs had become indistinguishable from generic cultural liberalism. So there's the first critique, and you can ask yourself if it's true or not. Do the beliefs of Unitarian Universalists, ministers, adults, you, are they simply generic cultural liberalism or are they something different? It was time to ask hard religious questions like, what's worth believing? Are there profound truths about life that make demands on people of character, whether we like it or not? What beliefs can be used to fashion admirable people? What beliefs make you better, make you live better, help you live better? In a sentence, the question was, are there deep and abiding truths capable of sustaining honest spiritual quests without supernatural underpinnings? In other words, are there truths that you can wrestle with that don't rely upon you saying, this is important because God said it was important, or this is important because my guru said it was important, or something else? Are there deep and abiding truths capable of sustaining honest spiritual quests? Now, these are good questions, the sort that we should and hopefully are asking on a regular basis. As to whether or not this is actually going on in the Unitarian Universalist world is open to debate. Lair thinks not, and here's why. The lack of anything worth believing was a religious crisis, which should have called for religious solutions. The mid-20th century was a time for religious liberals to claim the tradition of liberal religion, a tradition that can be traced back 2,500 years, and educate themselves to be its new voice. It was a time to seek the legitimate heir to the form of liberal religion that their parents and grandparents had inherited, but none of this happened. Maybe the general narcissism of the times can be blamed in part, or maybe the fact that our beliefs were political rather than religious. And political beliefs are routinely taken with polls. And we know that all too well today as we watch the political system unfold. Polls are everywhere now. So instead of asking religious questions about what was worth believing, what was necessary to believe, and what beliefs might best be used to fashion people of good character and so on, instead of this, the Unitarians simply took an extended poll. They asked a handful of churches, including the first church I served, so he was a witness to this, to hold discussion groups to discover what the people who attended there, and like discussion groups, happened to believe. What such a poll had to and did reveal were the generic cultural beliefs these people brought into church with them, the profile of social and political liberals. And here, if you haven't had anything wrinkled yet, you're going to love the next paragraph. This process produced the seven principles, known in some circles as the seven banalities or the seven dwarves, which soon became the de facto creed of a brand new religion called Unitarian Universalism, a religion that had never before existed anywhere, and to which no one of any note in history had ever belonged, because, of course, it was brand new. You can't include those old Unitarians and Universalists. That's a different religion. They were liberal Christians, and they would not be comfortable in our churches today. Now, I dare say that you may have taken umbrage with some of these statements, especially when he attacked the seven principles. I don't personally get too emotionally tied up in the seven principles. I think they're excellent. I think it's a great way to run congregations and to interact with each other. But they weren't handed down by God. They weren't written in stone somewhere. They were, by our own admission, done through polling, through asking congregations what they thought, and were voted on and were approved by popular vote. And so perhaps they do reflect liberal politics or beliefs. That's something we should consider. I'm not saying they do. I'm saying that's something worth thinking about. So I've never found them to be truly distinctive. And if you join me for the second hour, I was confronted with the argument that true conservative Christians wouldn't, for instance, accept the first principle. And I demonstrated exactly how, indeed, they could and do if that wording were given to them. So maybe the seven principles, depending on how you interpret them, aren't even really all that distinctive from religions we would otherwise find ourselves at great odds with. So I don't get too upset about what he writes, but Lehrer actively dislikes them. Consider these words about the first principle that he writes. Our Unitarian Universalist definition of the human condition seems content with asserting an inherent worth and dignity. Only that? Only goodness? Just a big happy face? What about inherent evil? What about our inherent gullibility, foolishness, or selfishness? What about our tendency towards self-absorption and the rest of the shadow sides that complete the makeup of the human condition? What of them? If all of these potentialities are present, then we need the ability to make necessary distinctions between the inherent or adherent parts of us that are silly, self-absorbed, etc. And you don't do that by uncritically affirming the inherent worth and dignity of people as though that's all there is there. If strict Calvinists err by overemphasizing original sin, it is surely more dangerous to ignore it and cover the human condition with a childish, happy face. So he's trying to irritate. I think this is very gadfly in the way he's presenting this. I don't think the first principle slaps a big happy face on everything myself. But what he does say underneath the accusatory tone is, do we think about the dark side of people enough? Or are we just glossing it over and we're all just one big, great, happy humanity? Because there is a deep evil side to what we can do. You need only look at history. You need only look around the world today to see great evil being perpetrated. Finally, as often happens, and as I promised, I found something totally unexpected as I was working on my sermon. This happens almost every time I write a sermon now. I find a great quote, a great reference, or something not in something I'm studying for my sermon. So I've been listening to audiobooks based on the Discworld series. If you're not familiar with it, it's a humorous fantasy series. It takes place on a flat Discworld that rides on the back of four elephants standing on the back of a giant turtle that flies through space. And on this world, it's a fantasy world. You've got wizards and all the mythical creatures you've normally heard of, and many you haven't. And on this Discworld is the city of Ankh-Morpork, which is a true den of iniquity, if you will. It barely holds together, and it holds together because the man who runs it is Lord Vetinari. Lord Vetinari is one of those very practical, very cunning and calculating people. And even though most people don't like him, they like him a whole lot better than what else might be there because he makes Ankh-Morpork work. And he's not the sort of guy to sit down and give you a philosophical dissertation. He's usually a man of few words and just makes things happen. But in the book Unseen Academicals, which I referenced last time I was here about trying to form a soccer league in this city, he's sitting down with a bunch of the wizards and they're drinking beers, and suddenly he waxes philosophical and gives them his view on life because he's just been told that a den of orcs was discovered, and orcs are these horrible, horrible creatures, just unbelievably evil, and they have to be wiped out, every single one of them, even the babies. And they're saying, well, you have to do it. They're evil. And he turns to the wizards, and he says, I see evil when I look in my shaving mirror. It is philosophically present everywhere in the universe in order... And by the way, when I read this quote, people totally missed it, so I'm going to really slow down and emphasize this. It is philosophically present everywhere in the universe, evil is, in order, apparently, to highlight the existence of good. I think there's more to this theory, but I tend to burst out laughing at this point. And what he's saying is this is asinine. I don't need people to be suffering to know that there's good in the universe. I don't need the Holocaust to know that good can come out from people who are in horrible situations. So he says, anyone who tells me that evil exists to highlight the existence of good, I just burst out laughing. He's not buying this theory. At least a couple people thought I was suggesting he did buy this theory. He thinks it's asinine. I've told this to few people, gentlemen, and I suspect I never will again. One day, when I was a young boy on holiday in the Uberwald, I was walking along the bank of a stream where I saw a mother otter with her cubs, a very endearing sight, I'm sure you'll agree. And even as I watched, the mother otter dived into the water and came up with a plump salmon, which she subdued and dragged under the half-submerged log. As she ate it, while of course it was still alive, the body split, and I remember to this day the sweet pinkness of its eggs as they spilled out, much to the delight of the baby otters, who scrambled over themselves to feed on this delicacy. Mother and children, dining upon mother and children. And that's when I first learned about evil. It is built into the very nature of the universe. Every world spins on pain. If there is any kind of supreme being, I told myself it is up to all of us to become his moral superior. And there it is. Drop the mic. I'm done. I'm retiring. I don't have to say another word ever. If there is any kind of supreme being, I told myself it is up to all of us to become his moral superior. Now, you can argue that the natural cycles of life, which includes endless killing, are neither good or evil. They're simply the way nature operates. And yes, that's true. That's the evolutionary process. But don't lose sight of the point that's being made here. If we attribute the endless cycles of death and suffering to the deliberate creative process of a deity, what sort of moral center could such a god have? Would you actually take moral advice from this entity? I think not. There would be no moral center if the moral center of this deity was mother and children dining upon mother and children. But we can eliminate God from this conversation entirely and just look at it as nature or evolution. Evolution has created worlds that spin in pain. At least ours does. It created us. But here's the catch. Although we were created in a world that spins in pain, we can be morally superior to the evolutionary process, to Mother Nature, to whatever you want to call it. The animals don't think about the pain they inflict. They seek to survive and eat. We are different. We think about it. We're capable of understanding the pain we cause. And great thinkers and religious leaders have understood this throughout history. Here are a few examples. Siddhartha Gautama, known as the Buddha, was a young man. And when he encountered suffering, although he had been shielded from it by his father, it caused him to abandon wealth and comfort to seek an end to end suffering and discontent in all people. 1600 years later, Master Dogen, founder of Soto Zen Buddhism, concluded 1,000 and almost 600 years worth of study with these simple distillations of how to live. And this paraphrase, or this translation, comes from Brad Warner, who likes to put it in modern colloquial terms. Even if the whole universe is nothing but a bunch of jerks doing all kinds of jerk-type things, there is still liberation in simply not being a jerk. He also tells the story of a monk and his master. Kyoi, the student, asks, "What is the meaning of Buddhism?" Doran, the teacher, says, "Don't be a jerk. Do the right thing." Kyoi says, "Even a three-year-old could say that." Doran replies, "Yes, a three-year-old could say that. But even an 80-year-old has trouble doing it." A Gentile came to Rabbi Hillel saying he would convert to Judaism if Hillel could teach him the whole Torah in the time that he could stand on one foot. He converted the Gentile by telling him, "Now lift my foot up. That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. That is the whole Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and study it." There, now you're all Jews. The Apostle Paul says, and Paul says a lot of horrible things, but the Apostle Paul even got it right when he said, "The entire law is fulfilled in keeping this one command, love your neighbor as yourself." The entire law is summed up in that. And he gets rid of all the crap and just says, "Love your neighbor as yourself." And it goes on and on. How we should live is not really a mystery. We know when we are being jerks, don't we? We really do. We very rarely inadvertently act like a colossal jerk. We know it, we justify it in our minds, or we just don't care because we're mad, but we know we're doing it. We don't need to quote great religious leaders or philosophers to figure it out. So now we come back to our gadfly. David Sinclair does not call himself a Unitarian Universalist, but he acknowledges that he is more welcome in our religion than in any other. That's why he's a minister in a Unitarian, or was in Unitarian Universalist congregations. It is here the self-described heretical preacher found a home. And that speaks volumes. What other religion would let you be the leader of a congregation while rejecting the very identity of that religion? You know, how many ministers could be a minister in a Unitarian Universalist congregation and tell everyone, "But I'm not a Unitarian Universalist, I'm a religious liberal." But he could do it because we're that open-minded, or that we're that crazy, one or the other. So remember the joke from The Simpsons about Unitarian ice cream? It was meant as an insult, but it's actually a profound truth. We don't fill the bowl for you with predetermined flavors. You don't get command mint ice cream here. You get the empty bowl. And anyone who studied Buddhism knows how important emptiness actually is. It's profoundly important. When Lisa looks at the empty bowl and says there's nothing there, she misses the point completely. The bowl is there. We're not the ice cream, we're the bowl. Sample all the flavors. The flavors that have been created throughout history in all nations, in all times. But keep in mind the ultimate truths as you do this. Don't be a jerk. Do the right thing. that which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. It's easy enough for a 3-year-old to say, and hard enough for an 80-year-old to do. For those willing to struggle with this on a daily basis, for those to whom these things matter, I think Unitarian Universalist congregations offer a welcoming home. We may not be a large religion, and we never will be because we're too challenging. You get the empty bowl, and you have to fill it. You have to do a lot of work. Someone's not plopping the ice cream in the bowl for you. So we don't make sense to the Reverend Lovejoys of the world. And we may have issues to work out, undoubtedly, but there is no other religion, no other congregation, no other place I'd rather be. And I hope you all feel the same. As always, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming out and spending your Sunday morning with us today. Thank you.